Good morning. This is Talking Animals. My guest today will be John Homans, who's written an engaging new book called What's a Dog For? Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. We'll speak with him in a few minutes. Later in the program, we'll give away tickets to see Southside Johnny, who's playing the Capitol Theater this Friday, February 1st. I also want to mention that starting 1 week from today, February 6th, Talking Animals will be airing 2 hours earlier at 9 a.m. And that we've launched a brand new website, which I hope you'll visit at talkinganimals.net. All right, onward. We're kicking off the show with an animal tune selected with John Homan's new book in mind. This is Antsy McLean with What I've Learned from Dogs here on Talking Animals.
With all I've learned from dogs, I could write a book. But I doubt Doubleday would give it a double look. It all come off so simple, they just laugh it off, I guess. It's just loyalty and devotion and something to chew on when we're stressed. With all I've learned from dogs, I could change the world. Revolutionize the ways of love when boy meets girl. We get tangled up in drama. Ain't that the way it always goes? When it's all just simple chemistry, just relax and trust your nose. I've learned that anything's worth stopping if you stop to go play ball with someone you would die for and drop what you're doing when they call. And if your head ain't out the window, well, that ain't no life at all. Just a few things I have learned from dogs. With all I've learned from dogs, I could write a song to mend a broken heart when everything's gone wrong. It's tender territory, bound by a sacred trust. We mark it if we have to, defend it if we must. I've learned to greet the folks I love like it's been 50 years or more. And every road trip counts, whether it's the beach or the corner store. And yes, our cats have much to teach us too, of that I'm sure. Yeah, but that's another song. I've learned to be the way God made me. Don't worry, fuss, or fret. Trust my gut, love my pack, and live without regret. And 15 years ain't long enough, but we'll take what we can get. Just a few things I have learned from dogs.
All right. That was What I've Learned from Dogs by Antsy McLean, who, along with his Trailer Park Troubadours, will be performing in Bennett for WMNF on February 16th at Skipper's. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. And my guest today is John Homans, the longtime executive editor of New York Magazine, who just published his first book, What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. With the reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome John Homans to Talking Animals. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thanks for having me.
And so as we noted in the introduction, you're the executive editor of New York Magazine and have been since 1994. When someone's been in the writing racket as long as you have before undertaking their first book, I think it's particularly interesting to, you know, what they decide on for that first book and how. I mean, how is it that you chose to step into this fray with What's a Dog For?
Well, it actually had its beginnings as a New York Magazine piece. As a matter of fact, it was a story that I pitched in a story meeting, and not necessarily even for me, but it was based on my experiences. And a friend of mine had a dog that died sort of tragically, and had ended up in the process spending $17,000. And I thought, wow, things are really different with dogs than they were when I was growing up. And we'd just gotten a dog for our family. My son was 10, and And I'd been noticing, without really thinking about it as a journalist, that people were really obsessed with their dogs in a way that when I began to think about it, I found surprising and interesting. And then I quickly realized that, you know, I had a deep interest in this. It partly led me back to my own childhood and the dogs of my childhood and how we treated them and the outdoors and, you know, the difference between, you know, my, you know, sort of exurban life and as a boy and then my quite urban life now, although I escape to the country with Stella as often as I can. So that's kind of how it serendipitous.
Yeah.
I realized I hadn't realized before I pitched it that I had a deep kind of interest in it. So it was a ton of fun to explore.
Sure. Well, we'll get into some of those explorations for sure in a moment, but we should hasten to point out that Stella you alluded to is the current family dog. And so once you knew you were writing, you know, a dog book and you had these kind of, you know, initial thoughts and sort of earlier experiences, did you immediately feel like you wanted to weave in some sort of memoir element, particularly about Stella, or did it sort of evolve into including the Stella element to the...
Well, the whole structure of the with the structure of the book is much like the structure of my thinking, which is it went from my own dog, the dog on my rug, you know, out to the farthest corners of philosophy and science, and that's really how it happened.
Yeah,
and so it wasn't that I wanted to write about dogs. It was that I began to contemplate this thing on my rug, and you know, she was from Tennessee, and then I began to say, well, why is she from Tennessee? And I learned a lot about the dog rescue movement and over the course of the last four decades, and how, you know, they've been so successful in places like Long Island and this, you know, the East Coast and West Coast suburbs, that most of the dogs, you know, in that rescue dogs in places like New York City that aren't pit bulls come from elsewhere. Come from Tennessee, in Stella's case, come from Tennessee or North Carolina or Missouri, or and I find that surprising and interesting, and I hadn't known why that was until I began to explore. So Stella sort of took me into these different worlds.
Yeah. Well, and again, in a minute or two, I want to get into that further, because I found it really interesting, both as a animal person and a dog person, obviously, but also as, you know, someone who follows politics pretty closely and whatever, the whole red state, blue state thing that you get into. But we'll explore that in a sec. But yeah, I think the Stella thing really just does provide kind of a really nice, you know, spine or structure, as you say, or just sort of a bit of connective tissue, because there were times when I was reading where I thought, you know, geez, I'm not quite bright enough to comprehend some of the science here or the historical implications of this passage, and hoped Stella would show up again. And sure enough, she did. And I thought, okay, good.
Well,
that was
kind of the trick.
Yeah.
I was able to indulge my egghead tendencies while anchoring it in something that everyone could understand.
Well, speaking of a trick, John, I mean, from my standpoint, one of the sort of biggest achievements of the book is that you touch on sort of damn near everything dog related with a, you know, often with a scope and a sense of detail that makes you think, you know, hey, what's a dog for? It should be like a multi-volume set, yet it's somehow less than 300 pages. So
that is my editor's my magazine editor's brain is to create a lot of bite-sized pieces and put them all together.
Yeah, well, no, it was,
and that's why it's actually true that I that's part of why I enjoyed it. And I wanted to see. I mean, the excitement of the book for me was to see how many places and how deep and how richly Stella could take me. And so that was very much the point and part of the fun of it for me.
Yeah.
I mean, the reading was fun and the traveling was fun, and you know, went to Vienna and went out to Tennessee, of course, and went to Scotland where Stella's ancestors were bred, and so that was a lot of fun.
For sure. So Stella really then was the portal into the book and everything that sort of came from there, and you sort of fanned out from thoughts or ideas about Stella and how things were different from when you grew up to how Stella
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And she, I mean, I don't know if, you know, she's, she's in intelligence, not a border collie, but she, you know, she's a Labrador mix, and so I wrote about the history of Labradors, went to Scotland, where the very, very richest people in Britain bred the Labrador in the middle of the 19th century, and went to Tennessee, where she comes from, of course, and sort of explore the difference between the dog culture there and the dog culture here in New York City,
yeah,
and why they're in this sort of strange symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, and the thing is, you say she's pretty sharp and maybe not as sharp as a border collie, but you know, I mean, you obviously make clear in a few places in the book that dogs, you know, generally aren't exactly Mensa members. I think there's one early in the book, in fact. I think you're discussing dogs' intelligence, I think, for the first time, and you observe something like, but believing your dog is an imbecile does tend to spoil the party a little bit, which exactly right.
Well, it's true, yeah. And they are imbeciles in certain ways.
Yeah.
They are imbeciles in certain ways, but on the other hand, one thing I found is that they're, you know, quite brilliant and human-like in other ways.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean they have, and they're therefore suited. This is part of the reason. I mean, part of what I was exploring was why they're so suitable, you know, and surprisingly suitable for life in the human world. And one of the things I found, one of the things a scientist found, is that they're really that humans, and even though dogs are not as anywhere near as smart as humans, or even of chimpanzees or other primates, they have this quality. They're ready to be helped, which is very similar to a kind of human social intelligence. One thing that some scientists are amazed by is that they can understand the human point. If you point to there are two cups with food, one with food under them, and you point to it, they'll go to the cup that has food under it. And oddly, a chimpanzee can't do that. And the reason is because a chimpanzee doesn't understand that any other creature, you know, chimpanzee or human, is going to help it. And whereas a dog can understand that you want to help it, you want to show them where the food is, and a human baby, the first thing that a baby understands at about a year, the first linguistic gesture is a human point,
yeah,
you know, it's what the scientists call shared intentionality. You can concentrate on an object in front of you and share that concentration with a fellow creature, and then you can begin to you know, have some interactions about it. And so that's a way in which dogs and humans are similar as kind of social. And I was interested in that. I mean, at the end of the book, it made more. I was, you know, it was, it's kind of say, why is this kind of predatory, you know, wolfish creature on my rug, my friend? And by the end of the book, I sort of understood it better.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of chimps, I mean, one of the some of these things weren't necessarily revelations, but either the way you put things together. I mean, some things I did learn for the first time, and some things I'd either sort of forgotten or hadn't thought about in the way that you put them together. And one example is, as you sort of journey in the book through time and important developments, it's striking how many great scholars and great thinkers are also important in the dog world, or we're just dog nuts. I mean, you know, Pavlov's obviously going to come up, but, you know, when it's Freud and Darwin and Jane Goodall, speaking of chimps again, you know, all had sort of powerful, influential relationships with dogs, often that sort of propelled them into some of the work that they did.
That was, when I learned that, I mean, I had known, I'd read Goodall, and knew quite a bit about Goodall, but when I discovered that she was inspired by her dog, which is actually, she didn't write about it in the, I don't think she wrote about it in her, the name of it, in her major book, but she wrote about it quite a bit in her children's book about why she went to Gombe and has talked about it. And then I knew, okay, well, the dog has really been important. And I think that the dog is kind of has been this kind of philosopher's stone. The dog has been something for me, but also for these people, not that I put myself in anywhere near that company, but I was interested to discover it, is that the dog is something to think about.
Yeah.
Is that it's because it's sort of in between human culture and animal culture, and it sort of is a bridge to other kinds of worlds.
Right.
And you know, though I certainly use Stella that way. She connects me with nature in various ways, and I think about that. I think about how she's like me and how she's not. What kind of, you know, when she's following a trail and she gives me another set of eyes when I'm out in the woods.
Sure.
And I think that's the way the dog, I mean, I also wrote about how in prehistoric times, I think that's the way the dog always was. It was a connection between people and the natural world, and something to think about and something to ponder.
Yeah.
You know, the wolves were the earliest, you know, humans from very, very early, from 70,000 years ago, had a sort of symbolic, had a spiritual connection with wolves based on the, you know, you can see in the kind of jewelry they made that they, and then the dog became, you know, filled that niche. And even very, very early in the development of the dog, people would be buried with their dogs. So it was always kind of this creature that had a lot of symbolic importance. And that, you know, I think what I found most kind of moving is that that's the way that it was for Darwin or Jane Goodall, and that's the way in a lot of ways it is for me or other dog lovers.
Yeah, no, and the thing is, it's for some of those people, Goodall and others, I mean, it's not only that they had that sort of profound connection and their dog meant a lot to them, but in some cases it really did. You know, form the underpinning, or at least the impetus for some of the things they did in other areas.
Absolutely. Yeah. Darwin. You know, the human qualities of the dog. The dog has, you know, has loyalty, and has jealousy, and has envy, and has you know, joy and happiness. You know, it's sort of said. Oh, it's said to him. His observations of his dog. Okay, we are actually quite close to animals.
Yeah,
we are actually much closer than some would like to appear. And you know, interestingly, he knew, and people knew that probably if we were close to any animal, it was probably the chimpanzee. But his audience didn't want to be related to the chimpanzee, whereas the British at that time loved their dogs and were very happy to be related to their dogs. And so he used the dog as in that way, as saying, okay, we are close to animals because look at your dog, and
right.
Your dog it sort of opened doors for him.
Right. And even Freud just, you know, famously had one of his chows, you know, at his analysis session. So if you were going to go see
right.
Freud, you'd see Yofi sitting right next to you as you kind of poured
right,
out whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Castration anxiety.
Yeah. Right. Let me help address that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with John Homans, whose new book is What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. If you'd like to ask John a question or offer a comment, maybe about your dog, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So speaking of scientists and researchers, let's talk a little bit about the scientific and sort of psychological virtues of living with dogs, as you outline them in the book, you know, the oxytocin and just some of the other things about, you know.
Well, yeah, for there's been over the last, you know, couple decades, they've been the original study, don't remember what year it was, but someone did some research into the survival rates of heart patients, ones who had pets versus ones who didn't, and learned that the ones who had pets had better survival rates, and that was kind of the beginning of a thread of research that started slowly and now lately has been kind of burgeoning. It's still fairly controversial, but you know, the stress, you know, dogs, I mean, the thing that's not so controversial at this point is that dogs, you know, petting your dog, you know, will reduce, or just being in the same room with your dog will reduce your stress.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the interesting thing there is also being with people, will reduce your spouse or your child or something will reduce your stress. And the main chemical that's involved in this is something called oxytocin, which is the real bonding hormone that is very important in mothers bonding with their babies, and but also important in also social interactions. And that reduces stress and produces happiness and is basically a wonderful drug. And that's the hormone that's involved in your interactions with your dog. It's what makes you feel so good when you pet your dog.
Yeah,
and also makes the dog feel good when you're giving this belly scratch. And interestingly, and this goes to what Freud, some of the things that Freud talked about, but a dog is, a more recent study found that dogs, will actually reduce your stress more than a spouse will. Someone did a study where the scientist, I think her name's Erica Friedman, had people count backward from by threes, which is a surprisingly difficult and stressful task, and compared their success at this, whether if they had their dog in the room versus whether they had a spouse in the room, and found that the dog is actually a better stress reducer than the spouse, and the obvious interpretation of this is that, and this is what you know. Is that a dog is, you know, a dog's kind of is not judgmental. And this is why Freud said that the dogs were so excellent as companions. The dog, whereas a spouse is going to say, "What, you dope, you can't count backwards from three. but the dog is just sort of listening to your voice and sticking out its tongue and as happy as if you were just sitting there, and so it makes it reduces the stress. So that was an interesting, not so surprising finding, but it was a science confirmed what we've always known, which is that the lack of complication in the relationship can be part of its appeal.
Yeah, that reminds me. There's somewhere in your book, and I don't have this right in front of me, but where you sort of talk about that on the one hand, you know, there's only so, you know, genuinely profound an understanding that you can have with the dog. But the flip side is there's also only so much misunderstanding or something to that effect. And
That's the simplicity. I mean, there obviously, given that I wrote a whole book about it, there's a lot of complexity in our relationship with dogs. But there's also, and there's this fantastic simplicity. I mean, as Thurber said, it's the dog wish is to be as sort of uncomplicated and accepting as a dog. I mean, I also quoted toward the end of the book, I quoted an Updike poem about the death of a dog, where the dog is watching Updike, you know, dig its grave, an old dog, an old, very beloved family dog. And the dog is getting old, but is as happy as any other day. And that is a state that one might want to get to.
For sure. For sure. And I think it was in that same section about some of the scientific and psychological, you know, virtues of living with a dog. We're talking about Adam, is it McClosey? Is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and that you're talking at somewhere about some of his work, and then there's a point in there where, given that we're on a show called Talking Animals, you can imagine the way I perked up when you're explaining that one of his experiments finally went so far as to say that it might be possible to breed a talking dog. So I thought,
his mentor, I'm not sure if his mentor was a guy named Sanyi. And he probably was being provocative when he said it, because he was a provocative thinker. But he was also one of those people who thought that dogs, I mean, he kind of created the field of canine science, because he started with a belief that dogs are really super smart, and he had one of these dogs that's super smart, much like Jane Goodall's dogs, and could seem to communicate in various ways, pawing the towel when he wanted to be dried, and I can't. It's actually a wonderful book. I think it's called If Dogs Could Talk, but it's a wonderful book if you love dogs. Although you might question some of his some of his speculations, such as being able to breed a talking bug.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly, though, they've another scientist has there. I mean, some of these border collies have Julian Kaminsky had a couple of border collies who had vocabularies of about 500 words. And recently, after I wrote finished my book, someone has taught a dog, you know, 1,000 words or more. I can't remember what the number is.
Mm,
so the capabilities have not fully been plumbed.
Yeah.
of what a dog might be capable of. Although I think a talking dog would be.
Well, yes, I'm you know, giddy about the remote possibility of that for sure. So. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is John Homans, whose new book is What's a Dog For? And he's also the executive editor, longtime executive editor of New York Magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'll invite you to do so, 813-239-9663, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. And, of course, we'll be happy to hear about your dog as well. So John, let's talk a little bit about dog shows. A little bit maybe about their history and or just sort of the current thing. I mean, first, at this point, with all the research and sort of attending things and traveling that you did, I mean, do you feel dog shows are kind of a force for good, a force for evil, or a little bit of both?
I would say a little bit of both. I mean, I've loved watching the Westminster Dog Show, especially before I began to learn about the controversy over inbreeding,
mm-hmm.
Because it's a fantastic, you know, art form and the variety and the kind of elegance of some of these creatures and this kind of amazing dog creation. This incredible variety, and it's one of the things that's one of the many things that's impressive about dogs is that they're, you know, all of these are descended from wolves, and how can that be? And so I've enjoyed that, but then there is attached to that is the fact that the rules of breeding dogs, the rules of creating purebreds have bred in health problems because of inbreeding,
mm-hmm.
number one, but also because sometimes qualities, you know, as in Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, I mean, sometimes the qualities like a small head in the case of the Cavalier King Charles, or for instance, the brachycephalic breeds like the bulldog, the pushed in face create, you know, really kind of gruesome health problems. The Cavalier King Charles has his brain is not is too big for its skull, and that can cause horrible pain. And the bulldog, some bulldogs can't breathe.
Yeah,
and some. And that's a cosmetic, thing that people have selected for, that you know causes significant health problems.
Yeah, it's just kind of run amok at this point.
Yeah, a lot of it has run amok. Or German shepherds, which should be the most fantastic athletes in the dog world, a lot of them have, because they've been selected to have a low slung rear end. A lot of them have terrible hip problems and can't have problems moving. I mean, there's I see them often in the dog run. So I think that part of it is quite sad and is very problematic and is something that I feel personally should be reformed, and people are trying to reform it. I mean, even sometimes within these organizations, the American Kennel Club and the Kennel Club in Britain. But that's a subject that is going to continue to be fought over.
Yeah,
and I think it should be, because I don't think that those there are probably too many breeds of dogs. Even the British Kennel Club, officials acknowledge this. There are probably more breeds of dogs than there have to be, and the pure breeding rules are problematic because they can easily create health problems. And some of these. There's so many breeds that some of the breeds don't have enough individuals to produce enough diversity to produce healthy dogs.
Yeah.
So, but the other thing is that people have realized this, and you know, in New York City now, people are you know, rescue dogs are probably more fashionable than than purebred dogs. So that's a big change from my childhood.
For sure. Yeah. No, you really sort of document how that's shifted. And just one other thing I think this documentary, Pedigree Dog Expo, is really, especially in the UK, really got everybody to look much more closely at the breeding and you know, all the inbreeding and overbreeding and stuff.
It's a sort of a bigger part of their culture, and so it ended up being that was as big a news event as there was in Britain. The people of Mark Dare wrote quite a great piece in I think the Atlantic Monthly in the 90s about pure breeding, and now PETA is running ads and protesting on these kinds of animal welfare grounds, which may help hurt the cause as much as help it. But it's not as significant an issue in America. But the AKC's registrations have been dropping for the past decade. So it's one way or another, it's kind of lost a bit of steam.
And by the way, I should say, speaking of AKC, just before we came on the air, I got a press release from them saying that, in its much anticipated annual list of the most popular dogs in the U.S., the Labrador Retriever celebrates its 22nd year in a row as the most popular,
I know,
et cetera, et cetera.
It really is incredible that I don't fully understand it, although they're so sweet but they're certainly not the most glamorous of creatures. Yeah, a lab has never won Best in Show at Westminster.
Yeah,
but the lab didn't. Unlike a lot of those dogs, a lab was a hunting dog and wasn't shown until 30 years after dog shows began in the 19th century. It's always been a hunting dog, and that's actually kept the lab comparatively healthier in genetic terms. Also, there's so many of them.
Right. Well, I have to say, as a guy who also lives with a lab mix, I mean, labs and lab mixes, I think, have won Best in Show at many of our homes, even if not at the Westminster dog
show. Absolutely.
Let's take a call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with John Homans.
Hello.
Hi, it's you.
Hi, this is Tony. I live in Sarasota, and I'm really enjoying this show.
Okay.
A few years back, I was not able to walk for 3.5 years, and I had a combination Boston Terrier Bulldog mix that I really credit with saving my life, because I was in such depression, and that dog would jump up on the bed and bring me a ball and sit there just waiting. He'd look at me, and he'd look at the ball, and he'd look out into the room until I would play with him. And he would do things like that constantly. When my therapist came to visit the first time, because I couldn't go to her, he came up and he sat and he put a paw on her knee, and he kept looking back from her to me, to her to me. And she said, you know, he's trying to tell me that you need help. And she still, to this day, has a picture of him on her desk. I am astounded at that animal. He was like an old soul in a dog's body. And I was wondering if your guest has come across that.
I think that kind of thing happens all the time. I mean, I think dogs want to, certainly still they want and need to interact with you, and they're incredibly sensitive to your moods, of course. And again, as I was saying before, they are not judgmental, and they are not going to. I mean, if you're depressed, they're not going to. Allow that to stop them from wanting what they want from you, which I think is incredibly valuable. It's even valuable to me on my bad days. So with Stella. I think the other thing is that dogs are through these amazing stories, and it happens so often that you don't there that it's just not anecdote. It's not an accident that of dogs. Incredible loyalty to a dog, another dog or person that's died or is in trouble. They'll stay by the person until they're found, or they'll bark, or after the tsunami, there was a dog that's friend had been hurt, and there's just this picture of this dog sitting next to this a dog that was lying down, in this blasted landscape and not letting anyone come near, and then you realize that they really are there for you. They really are. There is something in their instincts and their makeup, much like people, that is going to protect their friends.
Well, thank you for your call.
Their dogs are unconditional love.
That's right. Thank you very much for your call. That's a wonderful story. Thank you so much. So, John, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, but one of the things we touched on at the, sort of the beginning of the conversation, and you just made reference to sort of, rescue dogs being kind of, at least in New York City, the sort of more fashionable thing. I'm really interested, as I mentioned earlier, that there's a part where you're talking about rescue dogs and just how things have changed over the years. And there's a thing where you say, most fundamentally, the dog market is an ongoing transaction between the red states and the blue states. And it's based on the same basic differences in core values that make our presidential elections so dramatic. Can you sort of address that a little bit for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book yet?
Well, I think that they're in the blue states here. We're more comfortable with a world of more laws and with more laws laws telling you what to do, telling you you have to keep your dog in a leash and you have to spay or neuter your dog and you can't shoot your dog and you have to pick up after your dog, and those kinds of prohibitions in the last four or five decades. I mean, I'll start at the beginning, or sort of at the beginning, in Levittown, which is the original American suburb. Off-leash dogs, loose dogs, were viewed as the second greatest problem after nuclear annihilation in the 1950s. And now you never see a dog that's off the leash except behind an invisible fence in these suburbs. I mean, where I grew up, now on the East Coast, there are no loose dogs to speak of, and all dogs that haven't been pit bulls are just not breeding. And so, whereas in the South, in Tennessee, these kinds of regulations, you can still shoot your own dog, and you can still, I mean, I don't know what the law's legal situation is, but on the East Coast, but you can still, that's how people, you're responsible for your dog, and you can not have your dog fixed, and you can not have your dog, or spayed or neutered, and it's the kind of farmyard ethic. The dog is your property. And that's not the way we think of dogs on the East Coast anymore. And so, therefore, there's that every man for himself, farmer, Jeffersonian ethic, still has purchased in the South and in the West in ways that it doesn't on the coast. And so I think that those, then you have the Humane Society, which is going in there and fighting, in fighting against puppy mills, but then once you ban puppy mills, once you raise the raise concerns about how dogs are treated, you're maybe going to after that raise concerns about how chickens and how pigs and how sheep are treated, and then you're into a different world, and you're changing the politics and making them more like us. I mean, I've already Tennessee is in Nashville, Tennessee, just passed spay-neuter regulations, and they had been euthanizing, 70-80% of their dogs, and they thought that finally was an unacceptable situation, and that sets Nashville on the path toward what San Francisco has done, which is remarkably successful in terms of its animal control, and New York, which is somewhat less successful, but still successful, but something like that.
Yeah. Well, no, it's just so fascinating, and again, like so much of the book, when you sort of probe into the the initial issue, the stuff underneath, and the context, some of the historical or sociological things that are affecting it, you know, especially from region to region, are just really, really revealing and interesting. So,
well, I was especially fascinated by that, and I do think it's red states. I mean, it's the kind of don't tread on me ethic. I mean, you can't tell me what I'm going to do with my dog or my gun or and that's not the East Coast, that's not the New York City way. You can tell me what to do with my dog or my gun.
Right. Really so. Interesting. Yeah. We have one, well, we have a few English, but we're almost out of time. Let me at least read one quick one. Hi, I can't wait to read this book. In the book, do you explore how a dog relates to a new dog moving into their home? P.S. I love New York Magazine.
Great. I love New York too. I didn't explore that, and I think that there are a lot of there's a lot of fantastic literature about that's more specific about how to treat your how your animals should be treated. And I'm not really an expert.
Yeah.
I mean, I could bloviate about it, but it wouldn't be as informed as you probably could be if you went to. Went to say Patricia McConnell or someone like that, who's a genius dog writer.
Well, and also, as we touched on earlier, well, the book covers darn near everything. I mean, it is still less than 300 pages somehow, so it can't cover every single thing. but anyways, we've been speaking with John Homans. His great new book is What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. And as far as I could tell, I didn't see a website specific for the book or even a Facebook page.
I don't know. I'm not a Luddite, but I don't have a website.
Okay. But you can get basically people who are interested, they can get the book wherever they get books, whether that's online or, you know, still what remaining bookstores there are. And it's obviously a really fascinating, sort of sweeping, cool read. And I feel like Stella's a pal as well. So John,
well,
thank you so much for joining us today and talking.
Thanks for so much for having me. That was fun.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Bye-bye. All right. This may be as good a time as any to remind you that next week, Talking Animals will start airing each Wednesday at 9 a.m. Let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. For fairly obvious reasons, I wanted to do a dog piece today. So this is Aaron Foley with a piece called Simply Dogs on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
We're thinking about getting a dog. Dog people, clap. Yeah? People love the dogs. I love the dog. I've never had a dog. It would be super exciting to get a dog. And funny. hilarious. I don't know what kind of dog I want to get. It just seems like when I look around, there's a lot of aggressive crossbreeding going on with dogs these days. It's weird. I don't even know what I'm looking at anymore. Like, you used to be able to look at a dog and be like, that's a lab. That's a golden retriever. Now you look at a dog and you're like, what the hell is that? It's like a face of like a Doberman, like a shepherd body, but it's so tiny. It's such a tiny dog. And I'm always like, excuse me, what kind of dog do you have? And they're like, it's a German Doberoodle. Yes, yes, yes. I don't know why I didn't go with German Doberoodle. Yes. I was gonna go with creepy, because it's a creepy dog. You're creepy and the whole situation's creepy. I kind of want to like push the envelope with the dog owners, you know what I mean? What I want to do is I want to rent a Shetland pony and take it into the dog park. Just to see the look of the dog owners' faces and be like, excuse me, what kind of dog is that? It's like a mutt, I don't know, it's like part Mastiff, Great Dane, Hyena, Collie mix. Something like that. Wow, it just really looks like a Shetland pony. I know, we get that all the time. It's uncanny, absolutely uncanny. But it's such a great dog. I mean, I haven't even heard it bark. It's just quiet dog. And then I'm gonna jump on top of it and ride it out of the park.
All right, that was Aaron Foley with a piece called Dogs, taken from her album, Lower the Bar. I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will win a pair of tickets to see Southside Johnny, who's playing the Capitol Theater in Clearwater this Friday, February 1st. And the winner would need to pick up the tickets here at the station. And if you play your cards right, I think we're going to have two pair to give away. But, of course, again, they would have to be picked up right here at good old WM&F since the show is this Friday, 2 days from now. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment. A look at items of interest in animal news as well as announcements of local events on the horizon. So, again, as we've mentioned a couple times, but just one more reminder, starting next week, Talking Animals moves into its new time slot 2 hours earlier, so every Wednesday from now on at 9 a.m. And also looking ahead a little bit, 3 weeks from today, WNF's Winter Fun Drive starts. And as is often the case, we'll be up the first day and practically first hour right after the morning show kickoff. So I hope I can count on you for your support on February 20th or before. And again, we're very excited about our spiffy new website that we just launched a few days ago. You can find that at talkinganimals.net. Now, on a little more serious note, I wanted to let you know that Scott Swift, a former member of Talk to Mark and former WMNF Volunteer Committee Chair, passed away last week at the age of 47. And on this Saturday, February 2nd, local musicians will gather in a memorial celebration. That'll be at 6:30 p.m. at Art Pool, 2030 Central Avenue in St. Pete. The number there at Art Pool is 727-324-3878. But if you want to find out more about the memorial itself, you can contact Gene Young, 727-656-7726, or by email at gordon.young@oneblood.org. And to actual animal news, let me just read this. This ran in yesterday's New York Times. Starts off, "For all the adorable images of cats that play the piano, flush the toilet, mew melodiously, and find their way back home over hundreds of miles, scientists have identified a shocking new truth. Cats are far deadlier than anyone realized. In a report that scaled up local surveys and pilot studies to national dimension, scientists from the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and the Fish and Wildlife Services estimated that domestic cats in the United States, both the pet fluffies that spend part of the day outdoors and the unnamed strays and ferals that never leave it, kill a median of 2.4 billion birds and 12.3 billion mammals a year, most of them native mammals like shrews, chipmunks, and voles, rather than introduced pests like the Norway rat. The estimated kill rates are 2 to 4 times higher than mortality figures previously bandied about and position the domestic cat as one of the single greatest human-linked threats to wildlife in the nation." Peter Mara of the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and an author of the report said the mortality figures that emerged from the new model, quote, "are shockingly high. When we ran the model, we didn't know what to expect," said Dr. Marr, who performed the analysis with his colleagues, Scott R. Loss and Tom Will of the Fish and Wildlife Service. "We were absolutely stunned by the results." The study appeared Tuesday in the journal Nature Communications. You can find out more there online or by reading the New York Times piece online. And this story actually ran, there have been follow-ups the last few days, but as you probably know by now, 15,000 crocodiles escaped from a South African reptile farm along the border with Botswana last week. Driving rains forced the Limpopo River over its banks on the morning that this all happened near the crocodile farm, and the farm's owners, fearing that the raging flood waters would crush the walls of the crocs' houses, opened the gates, springing the crocodiles, and about half, more than half now, I think, have been captured, and but still a few thousand at least on the loose. Locally here, just want to let you know, this Saturday, February 2nd, at Safety Harbor Public Library, there's a program called Tailwagging Tutors, A Dog is a Reader's Best Friend. Is your child nervous about reading? Tailwagging Tutors may be the answer. These dogs are specially trained to listen patiently while the child practices reading and gains more confidence. For more information, you can call 727-724-1525. Also coming up, Nina Perina of Love All Beings Pet Sitting LLC is co-hosting Ride to the Rescue on Sunday, February 10th from noon to 5 p.m. at Quaker Steak and Lube Restaurant located in Clearwater. The number there is 727-572-WING. The event proceeds will benefit Pug Rescue of Florida. There'll be a biker dog contest, raffles, and music by the band Full Tilt. More information on that can be had by calling Tanya at 615-310-8474. And also coming up, there's a workshop to learn how to communicate with animals that's going to be presented by Mary Getton, who says she's a telepathic animal communicator as well as author and marine naturalist. That's going to be in Sarasota the weekend of February 16 and 17. From noon to 5 p.m. both days. So to find out more or to register, you can go to marygetten, GETTEN.com, or call 941-752-5761 to register. All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We got to get into our Name That Animal tune here. So let's do that before we get too much further into this. You can call in at 813-239-9663 and name this animal tune. You will get a pair of tickets to see Southside Johnny at the Capitol Theater. This Friday, February 1st. Again, you do need to come to the station to pick up the tickets, and we actually have two pair that we could possibly give away. So 813-239-9663.
You got to get behind a mule in the morning and fly. Get behind a mule in the morning and fly. Chop to the axe in the woods. You got to meet me by the fall down tree. A shovel of dirt upon a coffin lid, and I know to come looking for me, boys. I know they're coming looking for me. Got to get behind a mule, yeah.
All right, we do seem to have a phone bank full of folks. Hi, can you name that animal tune?
Oh, I cannot.
What's that?
I can't name the animal tune. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, all right. Let's try again next week. Thanks for calling. Hi, can you name that animal tune?
I will make a wild guess. Is get behind the mule.
That's right. Cool. What is your first name, sir?
John.
John, and can you come to the station to pick up your tickets to see Southside Johnny this Friday at the Capitol?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Stay on hold. I'll get your information.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we had some other folks. I have one more pair I can give away. So if you want to call back, I'll give some other quiz question or maybe just give you a pair. So 813-239-9663. All right, we have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday, February 6th, in our new time of 9 a.m., when our guest will be Stephen Wise, president of the Non-Human Rights Project, an author, attorney, professor, and legal scholar who specializes in animal protection issues, primatology, and animal intelligence. I hope you'll join me for that next Wednesday. Also, hope you visit our spiffy new website, talkinganimals.net, and we also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. Our thanks, as always, to Libby Busalis, who helped tremendously with the new website and in other ways, as always. So, I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. All right, we've triggered another avalanche of people looking for tickets, I guess. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you, are you calling about the tickets?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the thing. Can you tell me the connection between our song by Tom Waits and Southside Johnny? Can you think of any connection at all?
Tom Waits wrote the song and Southside Johnny covered it.
I think that's close enough. I was thinking that Southside Johnny put out a whole album of Tom Waits covers a couple, 3 years ago, so maybe longer than that. But that's close enough. What is your first name, sir?
Mark.
Mark? Okay, cool. Well, we're going to send you. You can come to the station and get your tickets before Friday?
Yes, sir.
Okay, absolutely. Cool. I'm going to put you back on hold. Congratulations. Thanks. All right, folks. It's Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday again at 9 a.m. We're closing out today's show with an animal tune on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday. Did I mention it's at 9 a.m. now? On Talking Animals. Take care. Have a great week. Speak to you soon.
I was fine.